Welcome back to Cambro Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 240 of the podcast. And I'm joined in conversation by Stephen Clark. Stephen is a property investor, developer, mentor, and educator, as well as the co-host of the Scottish Property Podcast. You can expect to learn how Stephen freed himself from a life of working offshore through his property investments, the mistakes he made along the way, which you can then avoid, and the importance of knowing your internal driver for doing the hard work when it really matters and really counts. You'll also hear about striking the balance between investing in yourself and your business and satisfying those material desires that we all have, how to define success, and why stopping working and retiring completely is far more of a curse than it is a blessing. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Clean Foods Meal Prep. The removal of over 90 minutes of cooking and meal prep each week for me has been a massive win and a real game changer when it allows for more productivity and more time for me to focus on the things that really matter. The meals are tastier and more varied than the ingredients I would manage to cook myself, and they are delivered to your door on a Monday or a Thursday to keep you going throughout the week and hit those nutritional goals that you've got to really fuel what you're up to without taking away from maybe some of the other things that you really care about working on. The meals are cooked in Glasgow each week and delivered across the UK, and you can use the code CAMBRO to save 15% off your order. You can click the link in the show notes, which is cleanfoodsmealprep.com, to get your order in today and make sure that you're outsourcing an area of your life that can be done better by somebody else and free up time for you to work on the things that really, really matter. If you're new here, make sure you've hit that follow or subscribe button, whatever platform you're listening on. And if you're enjoying this podcast on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, make sure you hit that 5-star rating button. We've just smashed through 455 star ratings on Spotify, and the podcast continues to grow into the top 1% globally. And that cannot happen without the support of people like you. I am recording this introduction from my Airbnb in JBR. I've had a fantastic time out here in Dubai, and we've recorded 4 more big episodes, so you do not want to miss what's coming up. And I'm really excited for the direction that the show is going in. And I'm really excited to bring you this conversation with Stephen Clark after the music plays. Stephen, welcome to the show. I feel this one's overdue.
Thanks very much for having me on. I'm excited about this one.
Yeah, and when I was thinking where to start, I heard you describe yourself on your own podcast as a property slut. What does that entail?
Asset collector, property slut, yeah. I love all things property. Whether it be flipping property, buying it, holding it, getting the rental income from it, selling the deal onto someone else. Like, I just love everything about property and the asset class itself. So yeah, I think the fact I'm called a property slut is not because I've just got a buy-to-let portfolio or just done commercial or I've done a student block. It's like I will dabble in every strategy and property because I just enjoy the full industry, the area of it.
Yeah, when did that interest first start?
Apparently, the first time I ever went abroad on a family holiday was 15. We went to Menorca and I got one of the disposable, Polaroid cameras that you get. And my mum actually just gave me the pictures from that, I think, like literally a couple of weeks ago. So it's funny you say this. And apparently, instead of taking pictures of women in bikinis that you'd expect a 15-year-old to do, I'm walking along the front of the Esplanade or but then by the pier, taking pictures of all these beautiful properties and like, oh, look at that house, look at that. I think from a young age, for some strange reason.
In terms of like the actual architecture you were interested in?
Yeah, I think in a different life, or if I chose a different path, it probably would have been something in construction. Architecture probably would have been the right route. I don't know what it was.
What about from like a financial perspective? Because clearly that's how people see you now. What seeds were planted that could possibly point to the guy that's gone on to sit in front of me now?
Most people, when you look at a Sunday rich list when you're growing up and you're trying to figure out your path in life, and you look at the top 100 people and you look at them and most of them are, most of them have made their millions through a property. And it almost planted a seed. And if I think about any influences growing up, because no one in my family, no one in my extended family, friends, circle had property, had businesses, had any kind of success, had money. There was probably 2 friends that I can think of growing up and their parents had property. And it was interesting that we say I'm a property slut and like to do anything. Is one of their dads had retired from the RAF and he flipped and developed properties and sold them on, nice big houses up by St. Andrews and stuff, and at the time probably 700-800 grand, and I always thought that was quite fascinating. I'll look at the cash he's making from that. And another one of my friends at the time her dad had came over from the Netherlands with a bit of cash, not a huge amount, but ended up buying these like £10,000 shithole flats in Glenrothes, you know, three bed flats that were at the time, I think most of them had been knocked down, but they were like 11, 12 grand. And they would rent for 350, 400 quid a month. And I'm thinking, fuck me, like, what a turn. Like, imagine having, he's got 10 of them. You know, there's a few £1,000 a month in income just from that. So I suppose at that influential time growing up, 15, 16, 17, trying to figure out what the hell you want to do with the world, seeing these two guys that were involved in property that I thought were successful and had money, property was the route. So I was heavily focused on...
With these two friends... Dads, were you inquisitive of what they were up to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would go and I'd go and help out my friend Mike's dad on a building site and ask him, you know, how much did you buy this for? What are you going to spend on it? And I always quite liked his attitude to life. Like, he used to always walk about, I think I was at the time I was 17 maybe when I was helping him out in the building site. He had a Vauxhall Cavalier, and I had a Vauxhall Cavalier, like the exact same car. And like, you know, he's maybe in his 50s, but he looked like a worker. He just looked like this tramp, like look like an average guy in about in his rigger bits, just, you know, going to a site. But I mean, he was selling these properties for, you know, 800 grand, buying them for a couple hundred grand, buying houses out in Marbella. Like he bought himself an AC Cobra. He had wealth, but to look at him, you would just think he was like a 17-year-old schoolboy that had a Vauxhall Cavalier, and he looked like he was just a worker. So I quite liked that. And then the other dad, I did help him out a lot. Every time there was a tenant that trashed the property and made a mess of it, you know, I'd always go and help them out. Like, yeah, you know, do you want to earn some cash? I'll give you 20 quid for a day's graft clearing out this flat. And you just see the absolute shithole they left. And so I did want to get exposed to it and ask as much questions as I can. And obviously I just go online and look at, you know, how much was a £13,000 loan to buy that flat? You know, how I could pay that off in 7 years with a 7-year loan, then it'd be my property. And then I'd be able to get this 375.
Straight away, the numbers were ticking over in your head.
Yeah, straight away, always to the numbers. The numbers always made sense to me for some reason.
I think that's an important realization though, because when you look at what you've gone on to do, it makes a lot more sense when you understand those influences, but also the fact that you were getting into the nitty gritty with those, because if it had just been based on you quite like the architecture in Mallorca, or you were quite interested in the fact that your friend's dad maybe had a bit more money and a bit more affluence, he had the house in Marbella, that's cool. And you realise how he got there. But when you're actually asking them, like, and what was the loan on this one? And what's the rental on this? You're really starting to understand why you've built a level of mastery in a sector.
Yeah. I did. The numbers really appealed to me. Even at school, literacy, English, you know, just scraping by, bare minimum, maths, you know, easy. There's a black and white, there's an answer to it, there's an exact answer. I don't think something where there's a grey area, which is... I suppose at the same time, my dad buying our family's first property was quite influential in that time. And I remember him buying it, I think it was £42,500. It was a repossession from a farmer. And him and his friend, you know, knocked down the roof and turned this two-bedroom cottage into a five-bed house that we lived in. But not long after that, or after the main construction was getting done, my dad had a bad car accident and broke his femur. So him escaping the poor area that we grew up in to move to the countryside and get this house, quickly his income dried up and he didn't work. So I basically lived in a building site most of my childhood, bare plaster on the walls, no central heating been installed, just bare floorboards. So, you know, sleeping by before we can get furniture and stuff like that. So there was a bit of hardship growing up around property, which taught you, well, you know, shit, my dad's got this loan out. He's bought this property. He's now got a home improvement loan that they're to the wall on it, and because he's now not got the steady income, he's now struggling to finish this property. So as much as property for me always signified wealth and growth, it was also a bit of a pain point.
You were also getting involved with a buy-to-let portfolio where the tenants had trashed the place. So you saw the reality of that too.
Oh, absolutely. I remember one of the ones that I helped him strip out. He left me for the day, and he had a skip outside on a second floor of this tenement block, and I was just launching all the shit out the window, and I ended up hitting a guy with a bit of wood since it bounced off the skip and hit him, and as he came back to deal with this issue that I'd caused, and he gave the guy 100 quid and he went on his way. I remember saying, like, how the hell did I get that stuff off the wall? And he was like, yeah, that's baby shit. And I'm like, what? Like, a tenant's just got their child's nappy and drew scum or whatever on the wall off of this property. I'm like, fuck, like, yeah. So I saw literally the shit side of property from probably when I was 15, 16.
Yeah, it's so, so important. And what led you to then go into the oil and gas sector?
The route for me was all about the money to make money to buy property. I thought all you need to do was make money so I could buy property. I went a bit of a ski with route, like really influenced by my dad to go to university because no one in our family went to university. Tried it up in Aberdeen, lasted 6 months. I really wanted to join the Royal Marines, but you know, fell in love with my first girlfriend, and that pulled me away from that time when I was in the Royal Marine Reserve. So I had this weird like transitional period of I just go and work as a chef in St Andrews, where I'd work seasonally throughout school and college and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I actually turned 20 where I got an opportunity for an apprenticeship engineering in an oil and gas company based in Fife. But they, you know, manufactured subsea oil and gas components to go
so
offshore.
So all their clients would be offshore,
yeah,
Aberdeen.
Yeah, so it was all based in Aberdeen, but the manufacturing plant was actually in Dunfermline, locally to where I was. And I knew how there was FMC, the company I worked for, and there was also Moss Moran, obviously where the oil and gas come into near Cowdenbeath. So there was a couple of big employers that, you know, the guys that did well, the younger guys that had the nice cars were the ones that got apprenticeships with them. Then they went offshore and they made a good buck. So I'm thinking, right, I'll follow the money. My dad was in the oil and gas industry. I knew people that went in the oil and gas industry. I need to chase that route just to get the money to buy a property.
But university was a pressure thing from family in order for you to earn the money, or what was the driver?
Yeah, my dad tried to climb the oil and gas industry, and I think because he had went to college later on in life, like I remember him, you know, I remember him when I was a child, going to night school to do his HNC, he would always get surpassed by the guy who had just left university. So he'd been in the industry for 20 years and it'd be the graduate that'd come in.
On the fast track.
Yeah, on the fast track, you'd get left behind. So he didn't probably want that pain for me, thinking go to university, you can fast track it. But not knowing that wasn't really my journey. It wasn't what I was destined for. Certainly, I might have been academically capable. You wouldn't think that listening to me. But it just wasn't who I was, what I'd like to do. And I thought there was something with more purpose than just going to a university and getting a four-year degree and going on a job.
When you get this apprenticeship then, how quickly do you start to scale your income levels? Because the main reason for being in this sector is let's earn some cash so I can funnel it into what I really care about, which is property.
Well, when I started in year one, I'd already been working as a chef and income had kind of increased quite a lot off the level that I was at. So dropping the income into a first year apprenticeship, I ended up taking on two jobs. So one of the chefs that I'd worked with, a female, she was really, really good as a really, really talented chef. She'd prepare the menus and make everything look pretty. But I loved the hustle and bustle of cooking and you know, having the 70 covers outside and I'm organising this absolute chaos. So I loved that. So we actually made a really good partnership. So when I started my apprenticeship, she'd say, well, I've been given a head chef's position at this, you know, this country inn up near Perth. Can you share the job role with me? I've spoke to the owner and I'm like, I can't take a fucking job role. I'm just taking on a full-time like apprenticeship. She says, no. We need you to do it at nights. You'll do the service. I'll prepare everything for you. The menus, everything will be prepped. Just you come in from your work, come up here, cook, do the hustle and bustle and do like the weekend shifts. And so for the first year of my apprenticeship, to make sure I had built, was doing income or bringing as much income as I could, I think I was doing like 96, 97 hour working weeks, pretty much doing my full-time apprenticeship, going straight from there in Dunfermline right up to Perth and in the kitchen till 10, 11 o'clock at night.
And the driver there financial purely?
I think I've got this dumb hard work means something ethic in my head. So there's that financial driver to make sure I had the income coming in. Wasn't quite properly quite yet. But the minute I could afford to get a property, I did. And that happened in my second year of my apprenticeship.
That's fast though in the grand scheme of things, 21 years old.
Yeah, I do remember the income. I was only on £4.36 an hour. And who I was working with, he was an old school guy and he hated the fact that the oil and gas industry was going so health and safety, OTT, and it was red tape. So, you know, we would do a little job and you know, see a garden poker that was quite athletic and sporty. He's like, yeah, you know, we need to get that cable over there. And I'm like, fuck, I'll climb up there. So I'd, you know, shimmy up this pillar, jump over on top of the crane or whatever it may be. And he'd like, do you know what? You can come in on a Saturday and work with me. like, because we can get these jobs done when no one's around on a Saturday when, you know, like, no one, there's not as many people working. So he kind of guaranteed me one Saturday, minimum 8 hour shift. If I did 12 hour shift, I'd go to double time, overtime every week. So the minute I added that up, I was like, I can afford a mortgage. And that was it. The minute I knew I could afford that extra few hundred quid a month, I was like, I'm getting on the property ladder. So yeah, went for it the minute I could.
Was this 1 to 11?
It was 1 to 11, yeah. It was a one bed flat in Inverkeithen, just off the Forth Road Bridge. It, interestingly enough, when I think back on it, how all this shapes you and the journey that it takes you on, I negotiate a 5% discount, which to me right now, just, you know, doing this for so many years, and I was like, this is fucking ridiculous. But the 5% discount at that time, I managed, when I spoke to a mortgage broker and I was looking at the mortgages and how the lending was done, because obviously there was quite a lot of irresponsible lending at that time, that translated into, well, I need the deposit. If I've negotiated 5% discount on it, surely that's my 5% discount on the mortgage. So I end up getting the first property with 100% mortgage, which has always been my theme. Like, I've always found a creative way of financing a property deal with none of my own money. So even from the very first one, it's like I've just done it. I've figured it out. No one told me, you know, no one said it. It was just me asking these questions. So what do I need? I need a deposit for that. But you can base that based on the purchase price, on the valuation, not the purchase price. And the mortgage broker's like, yeah, okay, so I've negotiated 5% off it. That's my deposit. Oh, yeah. And away we go on the first one.
Yeah, exciting, isn't it? And it gives you that positive feedback loop from the start.
Yeah, like, fuck it, holy shit, I pulled this off. It didn't go smoothly. I quickly fell down. So when I renovated that property, I pretty much renovated that one with myself. Like, let's make a little bachelor pad, let's rip everything out. One of my brother was a joiner. They were an apprentice as well. Get them in. My dad taught me how to tile. My friend came in and did the rewire with me. Like, it was like just figuring out how the fuck we do this. Like, how do we rip this apart? How do we put this together? How do we maximize the layout? And it was just a lot of hard work. And then, you know, fast forward a year later and I'm back in the bank and, you know, the property price index has obviously gone up. At this point, I'm thinking, yeah, so I can actually take money out of the equity I've created in this property. So I'm like, yes, perfect. And by this point, I'd found a 3-bedroom house in Cowdenbeath. And I don't know if it was because, I look back on this and I'm very conscious of this now. We must have been going into recession. But the way it felt like to me, looking back on it, was I purchased the second property in April 2008, and it felt like days later the market collapsed. Do you know what I mean? Like, it felt like, fuck. Like,
That was the quote-unquote financial crisis, yeah. 2008, wasn't it?
Like, yeah.
And it was a very different financial crisis to the recessions we've experienced since, because yeah. It was the institutions that were fucked, basically.
The irresponsible lending I probably just mentioned, like, you know, giving 22-year-old me an extra 17 grand on this one bed flat, some of which I blew in a trip to Ibiza, and the rest it was a deposit for the next property. But, you know, at the time I'm thinking, well, I'm this property mogul, that's me, I'm going for it. Like, I've created this equity through this renovation, I've pulled it back out, I've bought my second property, like, here we go, like, let's get this momentum going. And then boom, stopped right in my tracks.
What happened during that period in terms of the property market?
Well, like, I mean, I fell off a cliff. I didn't sell that property, the 3-bed house, for I think 13 or 14 years. Like, it took that long to recover from that position. I mean, the most pundits can say were, you know, 20, 30% drop in prices. Some areas have recovered, some areas haven't, some areas have went double. Like, it's really area specific, but at the time it took the wind right out of my sails. But I always think that's all part of the lessons and the journey that you go on. If I didn't do that then, could have went even deeper, then fucked it. But now, from an early point in my career, I suppose, I was very much aware that property prices can go up and they can go down. Whereas everyone's in this, or most people that start out in this bubble that, yeah, property prices just keep going up. Yeah, they do, but there's also market trends that do come down as well.
It's an interesting one, because so many people are always predicting that this year will be the year that they dip again. But it's been such a long time that they have been going in that other direction. But as you say, it is area specific, because yeah. You can find areas where they're stagnant, houses sit in the market longer, but then you have others where people are continuing to pay 10, 15, 20 grand over the home report regularly.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a guy that predicts an 18-year cycle, and he's predicted that, is it Fred Harrison? And he's predicted the last two crashes by saying that over the last 100 years, you can predict the property prices. You know, they go up, they come down, they have a mid-cycle wobble, they go up, and then they shoot, then they have a little dip, and then they shoot up for a, you know, what they call it, the winner's curse, where they're just shooting up, and it feels like that's what they've been doing the last few years. I think when COVID kicked in, we all thought, shit, that's it, the market's going to crash then, and not... I think his prediction's always been 2025, 26, if I remember right. And when COVID came in, you thought, ah, he's wrong. This is the thing that's going to fast track it and crash it early. It didn't. Then you had this spike again. You're thinking, fuck, he's done it again. Like, it spiked again. It went up at a huge rate. So then you look at it and go, well, what are we in now? Are we at the end of that sharp spike? Are we coming to the decline?
Based on going through 2008, what do you do now to ready yourself for something like that again?
Pay attention to everything. Be liquid. Maybe being liquid is not the right thing, because I've developed the skill set to raise other people's money to buy deals. So I think being aware. I think when I was younger, 21, 22, when I was in that position before, my network wasn't including any other property investors. I didn't tell anyone I was doing what I was doing. No one else was doing what I was doing. I was just kind of keeping it to myself. So I wasn't meeting other investors, chatting about the market, the economy, what the politicians are doing, what policies are coming into play. So I think that being that more...
You weren't in a group chat where a policy change would get flagged to you immediately, as it's done today, for example.
Exactly,
That's really interesting, because your environment design 100%. Dictates that you're probably more able to respond to things now than back then, where if the newspaper comes out or the BBC News at 6 comes on and you're like, oh, crap.
Shit. I mean, even back then, I have tried to look into it before and see when people say when that crash happened. And a lot of times they're saying that it happened in America at the end of 2007. So if I actually watched the news and paid the slightest bit of attention, I probably would have predicted that, oh shit, something's happening or going to happen over in the UK. But it was just this blindness of, you know, almost like the people that are on crypto bull runs. Oh, it's, you know, Bitcoin's going up, let's keep going, let's buy into it. It's almost like people just buy into the property at that time. And I feel like that's happening right now again. I think now preparing for it with a whole lot different mindset, grown so much, learned so much, got a totally different network. I think most millionaires are made and lost in recessions. So I'm kind of excited about the next one, because I feel like that's my time. This next one's my time. I feel like I've clawed myself out of it the last 10, 15 years, that I'm like, this next one's mine. I'm going to go in it with a clear mindset, focused, you know, going to have so many opportunities coming up, I'm going to take full advantage of it.
There's a lot to be said for laying the foundations, readying yourself. So there's a reason that we train, so that we can handle the battle.
Yes.
And if we go through these periods that are relatively easy compared to what might come next, just ensuring that we're readying ourselves with some of the foundations we can put in place, whether that's things like liquid capital, whether that's a portfolio that's been mindfully built rather than impulsively built on cheap credit or very short term planning.
I think that's why that I looked at Aberdeen as well a lot.
Okay.
Because looking at the trends and how I think, I basically say that, you know, the first 10 years that I spent in property, I pretty much fucked it. It was like a lesson. Everything was a lesson learned. You were pretty much just getting your apprenticeship in it. No, you knew no one. You were talking to no one. You didn't have a network. You were just figuring all this stuff out yourself. So when I first became aware, I suppose when I first became aware that the difference in Aberdeen market was probably going up to work in Aberdeen around the 2008, 2009, and hearing doom and gloom and, you know, property prices will never be the same, the market's crashed, the economy's crashed, and all this kind of shit. And then you go up to Aberdeen and all you see is Ferraris and Lamborghinis. No, it wasn't quite that, but you know what I mean? Like, you just saw...
There was still real wealth up there.
Huge wealth. Like, it was abundantly clear that the city was buoyant, and it felt different. And I thought, what the hell is this all about? And then someone had pointed out to me back then that, yeah, Aberdeen doesn't follow the same trend as the rest of the UK. They follow the oil and gas price. So I always pay attention to that concept. And then when I started seeing properties appear on the auction sites in 2016, when I left the oil and gas industry, it started to kind of spark my interest, thinking, oh, let's have a look at this, because I've never saw property on auction sites in Aberdeen. It was always a very, very buoyant city. Now all of a sudden you've got an abundance of properties coming on. And it was clear that the economy had drastically changed in Aberdeen with the collapse of the oil price. Went from $110 a barrel to $20, I think. So then, you know, the losses of jobs, the knock-on effect on the economy meant that the property market wasn't buoyant in Aberdeen. And then you've got stuff getting repossessed, you know, a huge supply to the marketplace and nowhere near enough demand.
There's a lesson in there. There's like microclimates and you need to be aware of all of them.
Absolutely.
Depending on where your portfolio is, of course, then you should be more interested in one than the other. But quite often the trends start to map themselves out depending where you look.
I did a workshop, you know, last week, and someone says to me, why Aberdeen? And I just said, look, I'll bring it up on the screen on the laptop for you. Like, just, you know, it's on the projector here. Look at this. And I just clicked on us, and our portfolio manager was sitting in the audience. Says, what's the postcode for Urquhart Road in Aberdeen? It's a, you know, a street just off King Street near the university city centre. Pulls up the postcode, and I just click on it, and you know, most of these are just granite tenement blocks the whole way up the street. You know, born as fuck looking, but they're just usually 6 one-bed flats in all these blocks, and you can see pure comparable. So you click on the first one that comes up, boom, shows the records, and it just goes, you know, back to the 2021, 2001, 2002 prices, and it's like 34 grand, 35 grand. It just sale price, going all the way up to 2015, 16, where they hit 120, 130, and all of a sudden, the last few years, back down to 40, 36 grand, 37 grand, the prices I've picked them back up for. And I'm saying to people, everyone says, when would you, I wish I could buy property 20 years ago. Well, you can buy property 20 years ago prices in Aberdeen. And all I thought of was, that's a trend. So that first 10 years of, like you say, is training and learning the foundations and understanding my craft made me look at Aberdeen with absolute certainty and clarity, going, you're buying them at discount prices, at wholesale price. Like, just grab this stock, get the cash back out, and wait for the market, wait for the trend going.
In those first 10 years before you know what you know now, what was your strategy like in terms of accumulating property?
Not very focused. You know, I suppose the first ones I did at the back of the recession was I started to notice opportunities. I started to notice the repossessions coming up in the market, only because I just bought that 3-bed house in Cowdenbeath. I'd overpaid for it, paid an inflated over the ask, over the market value price. And because I'd studied that 3-bed ex local authority property and so in depth, when I saw these properties now coming up at repossession or you know, a little bit distressed sales, I'd be like, shit, they're good properties. So I started buying them and my wife's name before we were married at the time. And they were kind of classes or place of residence. She would move into them, I'd renovate them, do them up, sell them on.
Nice. So you were flipping.
Just flipping. But this is what I'm saying, I've completely fucked it, because when I bought 2006 to 2008, they're the ones I should have just flipped and sold because you were in this hot upward trend. And then when you look at the stuff that I picked up in 2009 to 12, 13, like, that stuff's doubled and tripled in price right now, but I sold them all for a 14 grand profit.
It's like a quick win, yeah, you took, rather than the delayed gratification of sitting on an asset. That's fascinating, because at the time you'd be elated.
Yeah.
14k, great, on top of your basic that you were making in oil and gas. It'd be great to see that happening regularly throughout the year.
Yeah, but it was almost that, fuck this, how do I build up my capital? How do I get my own pot together? Right, then I'll flip properties. Like, I'll buy that one. You know, I call my wife on this all the time. I remember putting the first property flip in her name in 2009 or 10, a repossession. And obviously I had to put in her name. Didn't have the deposit money, so I put in her credit card. No, I was going to put in my credit card name. And 2 days before settlement date, solicitor phones, how are you paying the deposit? It's getting paid by this card. And obviously the card's my name, not her name. We're not a married name at the time. She's like, you can't do that. You can't put in someone else's name. She's like, oh, fucking hell. She's had a credit card with, I think she was maybe 18 or 19 at the time. She had a credit card with like 100, 200 quid limit on it. Can I get this limit upped to what? 7 or 8 grand just to get this deposit together on the credit card. Now she was shitting herself. She was like, you just got me in from no debt. I didn't even have a car loan. Like, she was the one that bought her little car outright and stuff like that. Didn't want a, you know, a £200 a month payment. She was so sensible with money. And all of a sudden I've got her in a mortgage and this credit card. And she's, you know, her exact words at the time is, and she fucking denies us to this day, is, if it was that easy, everyone would be doing it. And I'm like, no, because the doom and gloom of that environment at the time was, property's fucked, the market's collapsed, this is a dangerous game, why would anyone want to get any property? And it was such a negative place to be in.
It's funny you mentioned crypto earlier, because the last 2 years I've been accumulating when people were telling you that Bitcoin was a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And now the number of messages I get asking me about Bitcoin when it's close to its new all-time high, and I'm thinking, it's so funny the psychology where you want to talk to me about an asset that's already had a lot of its percentage gains. In the same way, nobody wanted to talk to you about property in 2009 after the crash because they were scarred by what had come before. But that was the time where if you had your time again, you'd be accumulating these properties and probably still have some of them now.
Oh, I would 100% have kept them. And this is why I say this with quite honesty. Every single time I look back on that first, God, even the first 13 years, I'm just like, fucked it, did that, fucked it, did, you know, flipped all those properties during that time period. Like, wow, imagine.
There's a lot of experience gained, though, that's serving you well, though.
Huge, huge experience gained. And that's why, and on reflection, when we drive past properties like the ones we'd sold on for a small profit, like you say, you've capitalized that gain, taken a tiny little bit of profit, and you're like, Jesus, they you know, these ex-council houses are now selling for 160 grand. We picked it up for 58 grand. Like, it's just like, fuck, like they were good assets, good solid assets, good rental income. God, the loan to value would be so good right now. But at the time, you know, my wife reminds me, at the time, you couldn't because I had a credit card to pay off or I was building that pot, I was building that experience, I was learning my craft. So yeah, I look at it from that foundation of just training for that purpose. Whereas the guy, you know, the guys similar age to me that started in property that time, they just accumulated those assets and their portfolio was fantastic because of that growth period.
It's just the strategy they took.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what excites me so much about Aberdeen, because there's a doom and gloom. There's investors like I was and like people were back in 2009, 2010. There's people up in Aberdeen that are involved in property that are so scarred by the surroundings, by, oh, everyone just, you know, I think there was stuff in the news and stuff about, like, you know, people just handing in keys for thousands and thousands of Audis that they had to go and hire, fields nearby to dump all these cars on, like, it was bad, like, everyone's losing jobs. And so they're scarred by the emotional naysayers and doom and gloom around them. Best property investors that know how to work out the numbers, and I'm looking at it going, but these are just assets. If you're buying these assets at a price that ticks the boxes for your criteria and, you know, and your end values where you need it to be and your rental income's the way it's be, take the emotion completely out of this asset class, like cryptocurrency. If you want to buy the asset, buy it and keep buying it. Buy it continuously and just hold it. And you'll win long term. But I think, you know, everyone wants this the quick riches. But in property, you know, I'm not going to see the gains in Aberdeen for another 10 years.
But you're willing to play that game?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That's really important.
This is where the growth is. And this is why I'm so excited about this next recession downturn, because I feel like I can take full advantage of it. I spoke to a guy on the Scottish Property Podcast a couple of months ago, and he spoke about it from a probably different position that we're in. He's probably 20 years older than us, that he's looking at going, there's no point in me. You know, he's got a portfolio that's unencumbered. It's not a huge portfolio, but it's unencumbered. And he's sitting there going, I can take advantage of this next recession. I've learned my lessons. I've grown. I've got all this knowledge and I'm liquid and all this stuff. But he's like, when will I see the benefits in the next recession? And I was like, yeah, you're fucking right. If you buy now in your late 50s, by the time you see the benefits, you'll be well into your 70s. Like, do you really need it? No. Whereas
Based on age, you need to take a different approach. One of the most popular financial episodes I've done is with Andrew Craig, who wrote How to Own the World. And Andrew has a rule, 100 minus your age, and whatever your age is, you take away from 100, and whatever is left is the percentage of risky assets that you're willing to put into versus non-risky assets. So like, maybe like defensive assets would be like very, very basic stocks and shares, some bonds, and then riskier stuff would be crypto. It would be a property during a downturn. It would be something that's a bit more of a flyer, maybe an individual stock that you just really, you got a tip from somebody on that you fancy. And having that understanding of time frame, because when you're younger, there's much more time to make up, and you're probably going to go through a market where at the moment, if somebody bought crypto or they bought something in Aberdeen, the next few years are going to be really good for them, just based on the fact that they timed the market well, not through any expertise in particular, or they managed to shut the emotion out. Whereas if you're an older person like that gentleman you had on your podcast, he has to get this right, and he can't afford to take risk with that, because going from, let's say, £1 million net worth and there's a dip, that's really going to hurt when it comes to him retiring or leaving things to his offspring.
No, that's a good way of looking at it. Actually, it's quite a good concept. I think it's timing it as well. And I was asked recently on an event, you know, what's the end goal and when's enough enough? And I found that very interesting. Like the same conversation I had with that gentleman as well. Like, do you need any more? If you have 20 properties unencumbered and you're bringing in a decent income, do you, and you've only got one or two kids, do you need any more? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I've got a shitload more assets, but I've got a high loan of value on it and I need to pay them the debt. He's not, he's sitting in this position where he's unencumbered. So like, do you need any more? Probably not. So having that...
That's a personality thing then.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah.
What drives you? Because again, another recent guest, Adam Rossi, American guy, sold a tech firm that he built in like the late 90s, early 2000s for like 100 million, him and his wife, walked away, sold it on. They got bored of it, got sick of it, didn't enjoy the work anymore. And he's like, I fear this concept, and I wrote this down. It's called every day is Saturday syndrome.
Right.
The last thing you want when you exit from something that you've spent blood, sweat, tears building is for every day to be Saturday, because the fall off is, it's such a different lifestyle and it's not fulfilling, it's not motivating. He's not just going to go and play golf every day because all his mates are working Monday to Friday or they're doing something. So every day is Saturday. And he was like, it's a curse, not a blessing. And some people don't realize that. So when you're talking about when will enough be enough?
Yeah.
Maybe never.
That's a really interesting concept. One of the things that the objections I get asked all the time, if you're so successful in property, why are you still buying more? Why are you still doing these workshops? Why are you still doing this and the next thing? I'm like, because I love it. Does Elton John get to the top of his singing career and go, oh, do you know what? I'm in my 40s or 50s, I'm going to jack it. No, he's still touring at 77. Or does Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, get to the pinnacle of his bodybuilding career or his movie career and go, no, he goes, no, I pivot, I'm going to go and do something else. I'm going to get to the pinnacle of that. And the way I described it was, because it was the guy that works for me full time, he says to me, he says, you've killed my fucking dream. He said, I want to work for you because I want to learn how to build a property portfolio. I'm going to add value to your company. We're going to work together over a long period of time. So now I get 20 properties. That's going to give me my financial freedom and all this kind of shit. And I'm going to set my feet up and I'm like, no, you're not. Because the type of person that's going to acquire 20 assets with none of their own money, that takes a level of skill, it takes a level of hustle, worth ethic. It takes that a type of person to do that they're not going to just reach there and go, that's me done. They're going to go, what's next? Like, and I'm having this weird year this year. I've reached my goals, I'm resetting, but it's only because I always said over the dark periods and the real struggles, I said, when I hit 40, I'm retiring, I'm jacking it. And I'm 40 this year, and there's no fucking way I'm retiring. There's no danger, but...
It's how you're wired as well. And yeah. Like, I think humans are progressive beings. Like Tony Robbins has a quote, progress is happiness.
Yes.
And it largely is. And I do think, though, if somebody has success in one arena, so say the guy that works for you gets his 20 properties and he creates financial freedom, he could go and explore other areas, but not retire.
Yes.
And not put his feet up. I think that's a fallacy. I think he's very unlikely to want to down tools. You might have like a month, 2 months where you just go on holidays, you go and travel, you go and explore things. But then you'll get back and you'll be like, okay, I want to work on something.
What's next?
I need to work on something because otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. If you're not growing, you're dying, aren't you? If you're not progressively moving on and trying to develop a new skill set, develop yourself, then what is the point? Like, technically, I jacked my career at 32 offshore, and that was my financial freedom from property, or right, fuck it, I'm going all in this. So you don't just retire at 32. Like you say, your friends are all working full time. They've got families that they're doing on the weekend. So what, you're going to try and catch up with them on a Saturday or a Sunday? And what do you do with your time? You need, you know, something.
You become listless. Yeah. And could you imagine that? Like a knotless thread. It's just not how you or I are built. And many people that choose to listen to a podcast like my one sitting there thinking, oh, like it'd be fun for a bit to have some time off, but then I would want to chase the next goal.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes I do envy people that are quite settled and content in their mind space. Like they're happy doing a 9-to-5. They're happy having nothing else to progress, to drive, to push, because I'm assuming you're the same where your mind never switches off. It's always in the go. There's always something moving. You're always thinking.
I can be restless.
Yes, all the time. And it's like, fuck, like, you know, sometimes you wish you can switch that off, but it's a blessing and, you know, and a curse sometimes.
Yeah. I've done a lot of work to be content and happy with where I'm at and what I've built in the last few years in particular, where it started to accelerate and the kind of the foundations have allowed me to like build onto those. That feels great. And I'm a very, like, I've got a very high level of happiness and contentment, but I'm not ever fully satisfied. And I do want to keep working for more. And I find myself filling time with work. Although one of the guests that had a pretty profound effect on me was Nir Eyal, who's a expert in productivity, wrote a book called Indistractable. And he was talking about time boxing your calendar, which I do, but also time boxing and like rest. So for me, that is like golf, that is training, that's my walks, that's watching Rangers, that's, it's not going to the cinema, I can't like, can't sit in the cinema really, but like it's things like that that are like planned in, and I feel like they're contributing to me being high energy in conversations like this. In terms of the sales calls that I did before I came in today, like I'm flying.
Yeah.
But it's because I trained at lunchtime. It's because I built in that I'm going to go to the golf range at 8 o'clock till night to 9 o'clock with a friend and socialize. Those things are built in. So I feel like it's like planned rest is a great way for somebody who's got a similar level of restlessness to you and I. Otherwise we would just fill it with more laptop work.
Absolutely.
Undoubtedly.
You would just keep going. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, yeah. That makes sense. It does. It's have
like you must schedule time with your daughter.
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I think it's for me. It's setting the standards for what you want to live to. I set the standards when Maya went to primary school. The 5 year goal that I had up until that point was. Now this seems really weird when you look at it from a business point of view, but the assets were the freedom for me, the assets with the time freedom. It's never the property portfolio is never about the money. It's never about the valuation. It's never about the equity. It's never about the net worth. It's never about the cash flow. It's the freedom that it gives me. And the only goal I had for that first 5 years was I want to have the ability to walk Maya to school and pick her up. And it was weird because the portfolio was going at a staggering rate. That was going well. And then I quickly realized that I'd built a business and I thought, shit, I'm just going to build up assets and these assets will take care of my lifestyle and my you know, my income. Then I'm like, shit, that phone never stops ringing because there's always a maintenance. There's always something on the go with the businesses. So I employed my first full-time member of staff 3 or 4 months before Maya started school. And I realized that he was the one that gave me the freedom to actually do it, because if it wasn't for that.
And his salary was the cost.
Yeah, his salary was the cost.
But you just had to work that out. To understand that and agree with yourself that it was worth it.
It was worth it because that allowed me to achieve my goal. My goal was to walk Maya at school and pick her up. And as much as she's in primary three now, fast forward 3 years later, sometimes it frustrates me and it adds pressure to me, because if I drop her off at school and I go down the office and spend, you know, get there at 9:30, I know I'm going to leave at 2:45 to go and pick her back up. So I've got to be in the office for 5 hours, which by the time the phone rings and you've caught with people in the office and you're dealing with staff, that day quickly evaporates into a lot of unproductiveness, and it frustrates me because then I'm like, right, now I'm needing to work at night as soon as she's down, or as soon as I've been to the gym, or as soon as I've been training. Like, so you always have to try and cram everything. And so for me, 6 o'clock in the morning for the gym is a non-negotiable, because I need to get that in first thing in the morning. If I don't get in first thing in the morning, it's not happening. Taking her to school is a non-negotiable. And then I've got this period in the middle where I can be productive, but I know that it's the point where everyone else is going to be asking for something from me. So that's the point where I'm probably not that productive. So then that falls now on me. By the time I pick her up and, you know, do my jiu-jitsu, or I go to the sauna and steam room for my relaxing time, I know the sacrifice is I'm having to work till 11 o'clock at night, midnight, to catch up on the shit that I've missed during the day. So
there's a phrase that both Chris Williamson and Alex Omosi are doing really well to push now. It's like, pick your hard. And you've picked your hard. Your hard is, I need to go and train at 6 o'clock in the morning. Your hard is, during those 5 hours I've got in the office, I need to be productive. I can't end up scrolling Instagram. I can't end up playing email ping pong with somebody that I'm not being productive with. I've got to outsource tasks really ruthlessly to people in my team that I've built out that are able to do this job as well as I am, so I can focus on the higher leverage stuff. And the other end of the hard is, at night, you're on the laptop once Maya's gone to bed, and maybe you aren't able to spend as much quality time with your wife during that period, but then you've got to find time and another time to spend time with your wife that's hard. But that type of hard is on your terms because of what you've built. And some people would give an arm and a leg for that level of relative freedom, but they also sometimes don't understand what it looks like at that moment when you do wake up and you're like, I'd really rather not train today, but I know that if I don't train, I'm not going to be the best version of myself. Or I'd really rather not focus for this 5 hours during the middle of the day. I'd much rather watch this YouTube video and laugh about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. You can have an extraordinary life without sacrificing something, and it has to be all squashed into the day, the 24 hours that we've got in a day. Now, like you say, people look at that and go, oh, that's fantastic, he gets to pick up his daughter. But are they willing to sacrifice the 19-hour day, 20-hour day that you do to achieve that? Probably not. So yeah, everything comes with a balance point, doesn't
there's
it?
There's a price tag.
Yeah, there's always a price tag.
Like, are you willing to pay the price for that?
Yeah.
Like in the same way, like somebody might look at somebody's physique and say, like, oh, I wish I was like that.
You've not put
you don't understand what that takes to have that. Oh, must be nice for you. That's one of the silly phrases that you hear. And it must be nice for you to pick up Maya. And you don't understand what you've had to do to enable that level of freedom. Yeah. But it's really helpful because nowadays you actually get a pretty good insight into what people have to do to achieve that. And it's not behind smoke and mirrors in the way that it was previously. Yes, there's very filtered lifestyles on social media, but there's also ridiculous levels of realness. And across an hour and a half conversation that we're going to have, you actually find out a lot of what sits behind it, but also some of the really pleasurable stuff that you get to unlock too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I was keen to show that on my social media, Instagram, over the last few years of documenting that journey, was put the reality out there. You know, put on stories that I'm up in Aberdeen and, you know, I'm driving for 4 hours, but I have to be on site and I'm meeting this investor and I'm checking this portfolio and I'm doing this refurb and couldn't get this solution, so I'm up here doing X, Y, and Z. So I documented that journey. I documented being on site. I documented the pain point. So, you know, like you say, it's easy to hide behind smoke and mirrors with a filtered lifestyle, but with things like stories, people can buy into the realism and see the sacrifice you have to make. Fast forward a few years, it's maybe not as grueling now than it was back then in that period of growth. But like you say, people will still say, oh, that's nice for you. What do you mean it's nice for me? Like, you've never seen that sacrifice for, you know, we're talking about since 2006. Like, that's, you know, it's almost 18 years like that in a couple of months. Like, it's a long, long slog to achieve a level of success that, you know, that most people would be happy with. It's a long time. It's not an overnight success, is it?
No, it's not. There's foundations that need to be built and things need to go your way as well. What had to go your way to enable you to leave oil and gas and go full-time into property?
Maya. Oh, we got married in 2012 and we quickly came to the realisation that we weren't going to fall pregnant naturally. So we went through IVF. And I'm always very thankful of pain points and, you know, struggles. And when something doesn't go right, I always feel like it does, that something changes. You know, something becomes of that pain point. And the pain point for me was the holy shit realization of I might never have a family. And then realizing that, oh fuck, that's something that I've always wanted. So that became clear. And obviously the pain point of the failed attempts over and over my wife and dealing with her emotions, like it really mentally draining on your partner. And on a male, like it really is tough going. As entrepreneurs, as people that are want something out of life, you know, if you want something, everything's in your control to get that outcome. With getting your wife pregnant, there's nothing, you know, all the tests, unexplained infertility, it's not working. There's nothing you can do, and it's completely out of your control. And I hated that fact that this was out of my control.
You see, words really important when you use their control.
Yeah.
A lot of what the guests that I've spoken to over the last three, almost 4 years now, optimize for is control. It's why a lot of them are sometimes alcohol free. A lot of them train really hard. A lot of them have built their own businesses because they don't want to work for somebody else and be controlled in their diary. So not having control of that area of your life, and health is very much linked to that, is a really, really difficult situation. And I can only imagine that put a strain on so many things.
I mean, the control and with a lot of aspects of that during that time period, I was working offshore. I was doing a lot of time down in Africa. Health, I wasn't in control of my health that much because of the traveling. I was getting times where I'd be offshore where I can train. I wasn't training my martial arts, which was my event, my focus. So that was making me quite agitated. I wasn't growing my portfolio as much because I was working away. Relationships were a sacrifice. You know, something would happen with a politician in the new US and something would happen in the Middle East, and all of a sudden oil and gas prices are down and they're making redundancies, and then I'm thinking, shit, is my job now at risk? So there's a lot of stuff I wasn't in control of, and the one thing that frustrated me the most was the fact that we couldn't get pregnant. So when Maya was born in April, in April 2016, I said to at the time I was ad hoc, so they would, you know, pick projects. You're not down in this project. I was down in West Africa and Ivory Coast at the time. And you know, a lot of the guys are all crying out for work because the more you work away, the more you earn. And I was quite the opposite. I quite enjoyed the basic salary because I had a property flip or something was getting added to the portfolio at the time. There was always a property project. I'd run my mixed martial arts show, I'd be in the gym, so I'd always have something to do. When Maya was here, it was like, can you give me a few months off to enjoy my daughter? Then they understood the trials and tribulations we went through to get her. It's like, give me a few months off. And it was probably the worst thing and the best thing they could have did, because I spent 3 months at home and this sounds really fucked up when I say it, and I don't think people would really relate to it, but I started freaking out. I was due to go offshore on the Monday, and I thought that, you know, when your baby starts making these facial expressions when they recognise you and they're away to smile, and I was like, she's going to smile and I'm going to miss it. And I started crying, and I was freaking the fuck out. I'm thinking, if I go offshore and I miss this, I'm missing this. And all of a sudden it just dawned on me, if I go offshore and continue working the way I'm working to try and gather income to build this portfolio, I'm going to miss the most important things in the life, which are the most important things to me now. So I did 3 days offshore, came back from a quick trip straight in the office, and then I went in the HR and I says, can I get a redundancy package? And the woman just basically says, look, we're not meant to say the thing, but just hold tight, there's something coming out. And literally a week later, there was an announcement went out, we're looking for voluntary redundancies. My name was straight in, and I never ever looked back. It was like, I'm not going back. But it was quite a weird time, because I knew that I wasn't going to be mortgageable, and we were in a three-bed house, a three-bed detached house, which we weren't quite happy with. And I knew that if we wanted to be settled in a house that we were going to be long-term, we would need to move. So we quickly found a house, a five-bed detached house, double garage, double the mortgage. And I'm now telling my wife I'm quitting my 70, 80 grand a year salary job and doubling our mortgage. She's like,
I was going to say, you'd worked your way up the oil and gas ladder where the money was of a significant level, and you were funneling that into assets. But when that gets turned off, you have to rely on the assets and any funds that are available for you to start continuing to build the portfolio.
Yeah, well, I got derailed a little bit because we touched on the oil and gas price collapsing, and it was almost collapsing at that time. It was a weird time.
2014 was really when I first noticed oil and gas have a shake, yeah. And then 2016 was pretty ropey, yeah.
Yeah, I remember I think it was 2015, one of my friends had went the same route as I went from the Dunfermline plant offshore with the same company, and then he chased the money into the subsea engineering where he was working on the BOPs. And the route he went down, at the time he was sending me screenshots of his salary, and it was going from, you know, we're on a 40 grand a year basic salary. By the time you've done your offshore rates, you maybe made 70,000, 75,000 a year. His salary was with a 48 grand a year sign-on bonus, a 24 grand a year retention, and a 320 grand a year salary. I was like, holy fuck, this is the income I want. And I've already got these skill sets. I'll chase the money. I'll make that kind of income every month, and I will add an asset to my portfolio every other month. Like, I'll just bank this money. I won't change my lifestyle. I'll just add assets.
That's a huge thing, particularly in oil and gas. There's lifestyle creep, isn't there?
Yes, 100%. And this is what the big thing with oil and gas industry is, everyone gets sucked into that lifestyle. You know, if you're a storeman onshore, you might make a 30 grand a year salary. If you're a storeman offshore, you make a 70 or 80 grand a year salary. There's a huge difference in income. Plus,
you have a lot of time when you're home to spend it too.
Yes. So all I saw was this offshore mentality, is that people that would start offshore, they wouldn't keep their lifestyle the same as a normal person. Their wife would have the Range Rover Sport. They'd have the Range Rover Sport. They'd go on all these fancy holidays. They'd be like the keeping up with the Joneses lifestyle, where they actually got fell into what I call the offshore trap, where they're now, you know, making 100 grand a year, but they're spending 100 grand a year, and they're like, fuck, I can't jack this job. My wife's now mourning me. I've not got a relationship with my kids. I need to come back on shore and earn 50 grand, but now I can't. I'm stuck here. And, you'd see offshore installation managers that are in their 60s, and you're thinking, how the fuck can you be making this money for all these years, your whole career, and you're still here at that age? And
having to do it as well, having to do a choice.
Because they're on their second divorce, or they've not got a relationship with their kids. And I thought, I've not seen a happy ending of anyone jacking this at 40 going, I acquired 20 assets, 30 assets with additional
income. That was one of your initial plans, wasn't it? Yeah. Let's earn as much as I can in oil and gas and build the portfolio so I can leave my career early, not 32 early, but early. But there was no role model to look at that was immediately in touch to say, oh, he lived a good lifestyle, but a frugal lifestyle. He was conscious of his spending, but he had wealth. He had a nice lifestyle, but he wasn't balling out. And then he retired early because he had a big portfolio of HMOs or buy-to-lets or whatever he had, right? But there wasn't somebody like that. So it's really hard to see how you join those dots. So you have to take an alternative path where you almost jump and take the redundancy payment and go.
Burn the bridges. I went down I started looking at the self-development and personal development at that time, and someone gave me, I was offshore down in Ivory Coast, and there's an Irish guy that said, oh, there's a magazine, a property magazine. I'm like, oh, gave me this property magazine, read this on my night shift. And I'm sitting there reading it, and I'm like, holy shit, there's a network of property investors. There's a group, there's a meeting there, there's a meeting in Glasgow. So I end up going along to a meeting in Glasgow and went on someone's two-day property course through in Glasgow, you know, 10 years after being in property. But it opened my eyes up to the world of self-development, personal development. It opened my eyes up to, you know, the endless possibilities that could be once you knew how to raise private finance. You didn't need your own money. I didn't need to be going offshore and you know, chasing the cash, then going buy my own assets with my own money. I can use other people's money by buying them right, the way I actually knew how to do it. I knew how to add the value. I knew how to do
the innovations. You had so much experience that somebody investing with you and giving you their money to get a fixed return or whatever the setup was made a lot more sense. And those 10 years when you were like maybe fussing earlier about the mistakes you made and some of the things that fell off, that 10 years was vital when it came to you perhaps working with more individuals to say, happy to support you on this flip, here's 30 grand.
Absolutely, 100%. So we went on a property training course for 2 days and the guy I met with on that course was my first business partner. And you know, there was a few guys in the course that were experienced and they shown it with the conversation we had in the room or you know, shown an example on the board.
The questions you were asking.
Yeah, and you know, it was like, oh, here's a property in Glasgow, check this one out. Is this a deal or not a deal based on your experience? And I'm like, yes, a deal. Why? Because I just viewed a property yesterday. Then you get asked up, go and show me the example. So I didn't say, oh, well, I viewed this property for this price. I would spend X amount on it. Here's all my costs and associated with the project. And then all I seen was eyes light up. And then next coffee break, they're all come up to me and speaking to me. Do you need money for that? You want a joint venture partner? I'm like, what the fuck? Like, you guys are offering me money to do this. And it opened my eyes up to the fact that you don't need your own money.
You were in the right room now.
I was in the right room. I was around the right people. I was around the right people that wanted to better themselves. But and then I realized that I have a skill set. Like you said, I've developed this over the last 10 years. Okay, in my eyes, I've fucked it. Or, you know, I've got a small portfolio of maybe 10 or 11 properties. I've flipped a lot of properties. I've got this experience. I've built up this track record. Now I can leverage this track record and people will invest into me to go. And it was a huge eye-opener. It was a huge pivotal moment. All around the same time, Maya was born and, you know, just that few months was so influential to my journey. It just rocketed from there.
Yeah, we spoke about your strategy being flips early on, but one of the things that I've understood from getting to know you and consuming your content and the Scottish Property Podcast as well, you haven't been wedded to just one strategy, because you have guys online. So a couple of years ago now, I interviewed Tej Talks and he was massive on buy, refurbish, refinance. Yeah. Although we kept joking there was other R's in there. I'm sure there's somewhere in they're joking that for the property sector. But some guys are known for like, oh, that's the buy to let guy, that's the HMO guy, that's the serviced accommodation guy, that's the flips guy. You've really done so many different strategies across the time. Why is that?
I just feel like one strategy doesn't fit all. Like if you want to create a bit of financial freedom and a bit of recurring income, not one size fits that. Do you know what I mean? I don't see the buy-to-lets. For me now, starting off, maybe the buy-to-lets would be, let's build up a buy-to-let portfolio. I'm going to cash flow 300 quid from each property. I'm going to get 20. That's going to give me 6 grand a month. That's going to allow me to quit my job. Brilliant. But, you know, in that meantime, you need something to place your income. Is that sourcing properties on, or is it doing a flip and, you know, and
I suppose what can I generate to feed the machine, I suppose?
Yeah. And you know, if I'd be adding properties to the portfolio, something might go wrong in the renovation, you might miss an extra cost and leave, oh, I've left £4,000, £5,000 in that deal. If you scale that up to the 100 properties I bought over the last few years, you're like, shit, that's hundreds of thousands of pounds that I need to come up with myself. That's where capital is generated from flips. You know, so you could buy and keep three properties, leave 5 grand in each deal, flip a property for 30 grand and go, there's my 15 grand I've left in that deal and I've got 15 grand in my hand. So I think mixing up the strategies is so important for scale. It's not like one size fits all. And also I think that buy to lets doesn't give you the lifestyle I would want. So buy to lets can give you a frugal lifestyle. You're very much conscious of the cash flow and the money coming in and the maintenance that's going out and the management of the portfolio and the unexpected costs that you need to make sure you're factoring in. Whereas you go and, you know, carry out a property flip and make 60 or 70 grand, that's the stuff that, you know, I can go and spend money and go and buy a car. I want to enjoy a car, I'm going to go and spend money on that. Whereas how many properties do you need to buy before you know, £200 or £300 a month cash flow before you actually buy the car that you want? It's a long, long, long game. So I feel like mixing and matching the property strategies is a key to success.
Yeah, I think it's an important message, because when you consider that you've walked that walk and that you've built a lifestyle based on that, it makes sense that you're able to say, oh, well, if you do want to create enough wealth to start building that buy-to-let portfolio, you can probably need to make X amount off this flip, but then your strategy pivots to what you truly want your strategy to be.
Yeah, and I suppose it's all about what your goals are in property. Like, you know, you've heard guys in the podcast that have done property and it's been mainly sourcing and it's been the fancy cars from a young age. Property sourcing will give you that quick income and you can make a shitload of money on it, but you've not got the asset bank, and asset bank is giving you this long-term wealth, because when you're building up the asset bank, you're the profit that you're not capitalizing on, you're just locking it up in equity. So yes, your net worth's grown and your equity is grown, but you can't take a brick out your equity and go and spend it at the shop. So you also need cash. You need your sourcing money. You need your flip money that you can actually go and spend and go on the nice holidays you want or buy the nice car you like. So I think it's so important to mix and match the strategies and property. And there is so many options. And I remember my wife saying that to me at the time when I quit offshore. She says, you're going to be bored because you like a challenge. You like something new. So if you went through... You know, I'm probably at that stage now where, like, buy to lets and flips, I'm just like, you know what, I'm a bit fucking bored with it. So I knew it would come. But the way I looked at property is, and it's so open.
I call it multifaceted.
Yes, it is. Yes. If you build a buy to let portfolio, then you go, fuck, I want to go and try HMOs, you go and try HMOs. There's so many different things to learn on HMOs. Then you go, oh, do you know what? I'll try a part hotel, or I'll try a service accommodation unit. Let's go into that strategy. And then you go, oh fuck, there's a hotel that's been shut down. Let's go and manage a hotel. Or a care home or a nursery. These are all just property strategies, whether you're renting the property by the night or you're renting it by the month or you're renting it by the whatever. It's all just an asset collection. Do you know what I mean? So I find that...
At what point in your asset collection did you enable yourself to lean into your own material desires? For example, the Porsche.
That was difficult. I sat with a mutual friend in Falkirk having lunch when I got the phone call saying, yeah, your finance is approved for the Porsche. I'm thinking, fuck, I don't want to get... I don't want to spend this money. But I just added like literally thousands of pounds a month cash flow to the portfolio within months, and I didn't ever take a reward. It was like, I'm not taking a reward. And I always thought, when I hit 40, I'll reward myself with, you know, I'll delay that gratification as long as I possibly can, and then I'll get the Porsche. It was a couple of years ago I got in out, and I just thought, do you know what? Fuck it. Like, I'm going to have to reward myself, or what is the point? What is the point? You're not living. You're not really... enjoying life, you're living frugally, building up all the assets, working hard without seeing any sacrifice. That you can, I think you can burn out quite easily with that.
Was there like a percentage calculation you had to do to okay it with yourself?
I justified it to myself in many different ways. I could have done it from the cash flow point of view, but the portfolio was already cash flowing more than enough. And I tried to convince myself of the marketing strategy of it, the fact that I'm now selling workshops to help people, you know, build their portfolio and show them they can do it with none of their own money. If I've got this nice 911 here, people look at it and go, oh, you know, he knows what he's doing, because people...
It's part of a lifestyle business.
Yeah, people put success on the materialistic things that people have. So I was trying to convince myself on that, but I suppose if I did, then I would have just went for a McLaren or a Lamborghini or something flashy. I didn't go for a silver 911 that's like the most underrated fucking supercar you could probably get.
But importantly, it was a car that you wanted.
It was
the
car that I wanted. It was the car that I'd always dreamed about. It's the car that I'd always spoke about with my dad growing up, like 911s was
that. If you've got an itch to scratch, I really rail against people that are entirely anti-materialism.
Mm.
Because there's times you just need to enjoy the fruits of your labour, and that's what you were... delaying on, but when you did, you don't regret it.
Yeah, 100% not. No, definitely not. The trips that I went on, the conversations open up, the different networks that I appeal to, you know, I'm meeting people that are into cars and supercars and stuff like that, that was always my interest. So yeah, 100% not recommend. I 100% recommend, like you say, if you've got that itch to scratch it.
Lean into it when you deserve it, and make sure you recognise that you deserve it, and I think that was important for you.
Yeah, it was. And like I said, I'd looked at it from the cash flow point of view and looked at it, tried to break it down and justify it to myself. But then even just looking back at it from that conversation and stepping outside that, I don't deserve this, I shouldn't be treating myself. And then you look back at what I've done over the last 3 months, or I added £3,000 of cash flow to my portfolio. Well, fuck me, I deserve a £900 a month at 9/11.
The numbers go there perfectly.
Yeah, and there was another one. I started building up my stocks and shares portfolio, and I'd sold a lot of cryptocurrencies at the time, and I didn't enjoy looking at numbers. And I realized that the asset class that I like is the stuff that I can feel, touch, see, smell, whatever, whether it be cars or whether it be property. And the stocks and shares, I said, didn't interest me in the slightest. So I said, interestingly enough, I sold the biggest one I was in profit was a lot of oil and gas companies, but there was, Tesla was one of the ones I was in profit so much. So I sold all my Tesla stock that was in profit to pay the deposit down on the Porsche. And basically I thought, whatever I can sell in profit, I'll put in as a deposit, and whatever I'm putting into a month, that's my payment. And it added up. I just gave it the justification, like, okay, treat yourself.
I thought you would have had to explained it and justified it to yourself quite clearly, and you would have had to do the rigmarole. Yeah,
so many ways
to tick that box.
Aye, so many ways. You know, even when someone slags me off for being having a Tesla, oh, you're a petrol, but you've got an electric car, I'm like, I justify it by the way I break down the numbers. Here's my tax saving, here's the benefit for me, I use this car personally, and no benefit in kind. And you know what I mean? I break it down in numbers. Like, if it's, I don't know if it's the way my brain's wired when it comes to,
but recognizing that's important. Yeah. Otherwise you torture yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I knew that. And I knew the numbers on my phone, looking at my portfolio and my stocks and shares eyes or the cryptocurrencies in my wallet. I knew that wasn't exciting me. I knew it just wasn't tickling my boxes. But I knew that selling that stuff out and putting in a huge lump on the car of my dreams was going to give me so much satisfaction. So that was giving me the satisfaction. And even now I still fight myself. Oh, imagine I'm still putting £1,000 a month into my stocks and shares eyes. That would be worth another $24,000 plus my growth. Oh, fuck, what an idiot. I've just acquired another few million pounds worth of assets. So do I really need to bother about the stocks and shares? I said, nah, not really.
Speaking of one of those big assets, nicknamed the Dirty Nun, is that right? The
Dirty Nun. The Dirty Nun. It should have been called the Dirty Nun, yeah. The portfolio of shouldn't blocks. Probably, if I think about anything, any legacy... This is going to sound bad. Any legacy I want to leave to my daughter, it's the Dirty Nun. It's not called the Dirty Nun, just to clarify that.
Spittle,
yeah. Casa Maya, as it's known in my family. I saw and negotiated the purchase price of a block, a student block with seven student flats inside it. So it was 27 bedrooms. And it was a huge undertaking as well, because I had to raise the finance quite sneakily. Bank finance, private investor finance, plus a big project to turn it around in a short period of time. And it was a comfort zone stretch at the time because of the scale of the project. And to get over it and to go through the challenges of that threw at me was good. It grew me. But when I look at that now, that asset is the one that if I think about leaving any legacy to my daughter, it's that building. The building brings in $14,000 a month. There's a $6,000 a month mortgage that's paying off for the next 20 years. That will be paid down and given to her. What will that income be producing in 20 years' time when she gets handed? I don't know. But it's a 130-year-old building inside old Aberdeen. So I kind of went away from the oil and gas up and down. And I thought, well, the University of Aberdeen's been there. I think it's the fourth oldest university in the world.
It's got a great reputation.
Yeah, it's been there for like 400 years. I don't even know the history. It's been there for hundreds of years. That's gone nowhere. So inside old Aberdeen next to the university is this building. So the location's great. Renovated to a high standard to make sure it was a good standard of student accommodation, and trying to prove the concept that the stuff that I did with the residential portfolio for the last 5 or 6 years by lifting the standard of rental accommodation in Aberdeen to this huge standard where people can live in quality properties, maximise the value, maximise the rental income. I just thought, can I do this with the student accommodation? And it was a risk because of the borrowing against it, but I got there in the end.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see you go into that sector, and Bryce asked me a few questions about it when you were doing that as well, because that's a sector that I know really, really well, one from an insurance perspective, but then more recently from a furniture perspective. And student accommodation was Brexit proof, It was C19 proof, and it's going to be strong and resilient to whatever comes next as well, because the UK, touch wood, remains having a number of excellent institutions that have a great reputation internationally, and... like it or loathe it, the school system is still driving students to go into further education. That's how it's set up. Like, schools are targeted on, can you get 50% of your school leavers to go into FE or higher education? So guess what? The university places are still going to be there, so they're still going to need beds to sleep on.
Absolutely.
When you go there. So from my perspective, my side of the day job, like, we're continually growing because that sector is continually growing, and yeah, it's continually refurbing. And you saw with the standard that you put into that space, the demand will increase based on the quality of what you produce, particularly with international students as well. It's really, really high.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head as well. Like, the private rental sector in Scotland gets quite a bit of a beating from the government, and you know there's a lot of tax going on it, but the student sector, rather than renting the building out per room and charging a room rate with bills included and trying to figure out the, you know, the electricity and the gas and all that kind of cost, I did it on normal PRTs, like the private rental tenancy agreements that Scotland's based on. And so what I did was I got four students to, so each property is a four bed flat, got four students to sign one PRT for each one, but because they can't afford the affordability, they had to get a guarantor from their parents. So now I've got on each tenancy on every flat in that block, I've got eight people on the tenancy agreement. So I'm looking at it going, this is bulletproof. And like you're saying, in terms of income, in terms of guaranteed the rent, there's not going to be any crappy tenants that are not going to pay their rent or trash the flat, because you know, if one does it, the other ones are liable. If not, the parents are all liable for it. So it's I'm looking at the strategy going, yeah, there's a huge demand for it. I finished my 6-month bridging loan to purchase it was finished up for the 1st of June, or just a few days after. And I filled the building on the 1st of June, even though the university didn't start until September.
That's the quirky part of the market. Yeah. The students move into their halls in first year in September to start the course. They start looking for their new accommodation for the next year in like the January, February. Yeah. It's insane. In some cities earlier, like some of my clients in Liverpool, Manchester, let their houses for September 2025, like ages ago. Terrifying.
It's insane. Yeah. And there was quite a lot of publicity around Glasgow having no, you know, basically saying if you didn't have a place in Glasgow University, don't come because you're not going to be able to find a place.
They were putting them in Stirling.
Yeah. It's insane. So yeah, I'm hoping that transfers to Aberdeen. The standard of the accommodation certainly helped the demand for it. So it filled very, very quickly, and touch wood, that's remained there over the first year. So yeah, that was a great asset to the portfolio, and it was a slight diversification again on the portfolio away from
strategy again.
Yeah, absolutely. It was away from that different here's the residential portfolio, here's the residential portfolio in Aberdeen. Right, fuck it, let's go and twist into a student market in Aberdeen. And because the opportunity was there, with the city still being recovering, the opportunity was there to get the asset at a cheap price. And the lending's always tricky for Aberdeen. The lending was tricky in general for Scotland, because you know, if you've got a pool of 20 banks that will lend to you on the property, you go, okay, as soon as you come to Scotland, you've only got 10. As soon as you go to Aberdeen, you've only got 3. As soon as you go to HMOs, you've only got 1. It's like you try and limit the amount of red flags when you're buying a building to see how much lending options you've got. But this building, like, it was fucking literally landing on 1. And I was like, there's no way I'm taking an £800,000 bridging loan out to buy this property without having the security of who's backing me at the back end of it. Because it just made, you know, all this, every property strategy you go into, that, you know, you do so much due diligence, it's almost like a calculated risk. Like, when people ask me, oh, you must be quite a risk taker, I was like, absolutely not. Like, I'll, you know, sleepless nights doing due diligence until it's coming out my ears, until I'm so comfortable about the numbers, the end value, what I'll rent for, like, you know, I won't take someone's answer for it. I'll dig so much deeper than just, oh, Colin, how much will that rent for? Like, I know, I'll ask, you know, 20 people. So by the time I go to find the property, secure it, get the price, I'm so confident in what the exit's going to be. With that one, that was a lending that was giving me the sleepless nights. I was like, can I exit this? Can I exit the finance on the back end of this?
Yeah, that was the box I needed to tick in order for you to proceed. But that's fascinating how much work goes in behind the scenes, because to build out a portfolio of your size, there's hours and hours that goes in behind that.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be comfortable with it. Like, you know, if you've had in all your numbers plus your profit margin or your equity, if you've done all your due diligence and factored in everything you need to do, the risk is so minimal, it's unreal. Like, it's so, something catastrophic would need to happen probably 3 or 4 times over for you to go, oh shit, I'm losing my shirt here. And as much as I went over budget by 60 or 70 grand, which was quite a percentage on that
project.
What
were the main drivers?
Choice. Had known fine that this asset was sitting in my portfolio for the next 30, 40 years, that I might as well do the rewire now. I might as well renew the fire alarm system. I might as well put in click vinyl flooring rather than just laminate. Furniture, it's a bit more stored there. Like, just improving the quality of the offering rather than going, I'll do it as cheap as I can.
Don't kick the can down the road.
Yeah, because all I've got to do is have a maintenance issue in 2 or 3 years' time when the beds are all falling apart. So yeah, there was a lot to do with that. There's a lot to do with the scale of the project that I hadn't taken on before previously. You know, I'd done a couple you know, a few under the one go. I've done a multiple where I've converted them into a couple or two or three at a time, but not quite the scale of this. So there was definitely, how would you get materials to the site? How would you get, you know, waste off? Like, there was a lot of things like that that wasn't quite factored in. But huge amounts of lessons learned.
It's exciting, and I think that probably helps you again from like the education piece with things like This Is Wealth, where you've done yet another strategy and you've kind of had your hands dirty in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think for me, that's the only way to learn. Someone can tell me until you're blue in the face, like, you know, you buy a property below market value, you either renovation, you refinance at the new value, you know, you can tell me that until the cows come home. I'm not going to listen. The minute I do it and go through every single process of it, then I'm going to go, I understand this. I get this. I don't know if that's that lack of academic ability in me that maybe couldn't stick out university to do the full 4 years, that I'm more a practical sense, or I have to do it, see it, feel it, touch it, so I understand it to go, yeah, I know this. So yeah, I'm much same as that. I don't like to talk about strategies and property unless I've done it. And many times that you'd go on the podcast and people would ask about HMOs, or you'd interview someone down in England and they would be like, oh yeah, yeah, we, you know, it's quite an HMO strategy down here. And oh, fuck, I don't really understand it too much. Right, let's dive in. And I suppose my portfolio was at a different stage when I went to look for an HMO. Like, Bryce has just bought, he's went and bought one. I did go and look at one flat. I was like, I'll just look for one and I'll add it to the portfolio. I'll cut my teeth quite small. Then I was like, well, what the fuck? I've already got all this experience. I know what I'm doing. I know how to raise finance. I know how to do the project management. I know how to, I can do this. So when I saw this building, as much as it was that comfort zone stretcher on scale, it was a bit of, go bigger, stop playing it small. You don't need to think small, you can think a little bit bigger.
Yeah, and yeah. I like how it's very clear in your mind and your family's mind that this is a legacy to leave for Maya, because regardless of what happens with the rest of the portfolio, and I'm sure you're going to have really strong plans for that, that can sit there as an asset that will serve her really, really well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was key for me to bring up Maya as well during the Christmas period, because I pretty much missed, I think I took Christmas Day off and Boxing Day that year when I was renovating that property, because there was guys that wanted to be on site, there was guys that were happy to push on and take a few days off. So I'll be there with you. I'll lead from the front. I'll be on site with you guys and make sure I'm managing that project as much as I can. So because I was so absent during that period, I made sure that I brought her up and showed her around it in each stage and kind of, you know, the running joke. I mean, it took me a year and a half to get over the line before first getting the offer accepted. So it was a running joke from her since she was probably five or six, like, you know, I'm buying a castle for you. It's called Casa Maya, and it looks like a castle. Like, the building looks like that. It's that up on the hill with the, you know, the turret and stuff and the stained glass window. Like, it's beautiful. So, you know, it's always been Casa Maya, and it's a, yeah, it's just known in the family. If I can, you know, get that property, you know, no mortgage in it, and get inside the trust, that'll be the legacy that will get left to her.
Yeah, amazing. We've discussed a little bit of this already, but what would success look like for you over the next 10 years?
Freedom and the ability to do whatever you want to do. Like that freedom to take up any opportunity you want, grow in any way you want without the restrictions of finance. Because I believe that people are restricted by their finances, people are restricted by what income's coming every month. But like, you know, I can't take that job here, or I can't take that opportunity there because it's a pay cut, or my expenses couldn't afford me to do that.
I feel, or like, somebody's relying on them.
Yes, I feel like to me, that's what happiness for me looks like, is the opportunity to go, do you know what, I've got that financial freedom. If someone brings me an opportunity in a different country or whatever it looks like, whatever it may be, I have that freedom to think about it from a, will this serve me? Will this be a bigger purpose for me? Will it serve my soul? Will I be happy doing it? Will I get fulfillment from it? Okay, not, will it make me money? Will I, do you know what I mean? I think, rather than look at the financial benefits or constraints of it, I'd prefer to look at it from this, will it suit me?
Opening up abundance as much as possible?
Yes, aye. Living life on your terms and in abundance, whatever makes you happy, do it.
How close are you to that?
Pretty good, but then I feel quite restricted with Maya being at school, that it can't go anywhere I want in the world. Wife's happy in her career at the moment. I better watch cases, anybody else listening or our bosses are listening. So restricted to the location at the moment, but when it comes to doing what I want to do, 100% there to a certain, well, when I say 100% there, not quite 100% there, because I'm still reliant on location. But yeah, the foundations are there. I don't need. I started booking in like I said to you about before, hitting that milestone of 40 which was always one. Booked UFC 300 tickets to go out to Vegas in a few weeks' time. Taking my wife to Rome for her anniversary. We're going to hire in a villa for my 40th in June. Family holiday to the Caribbean in the summer.
Leaning into those desires that you had, which is great to hear.
Absolutely. Just booked flights out to Los Angeles to do a road trip with my mate, hire a couple of Harleys for 2 weeks and go around West Coast to America and then out to Vegas for a few days, stuff like that. Just, you know, everything I wanted to do, I'm putting in this year and I'm doing it. I feel like it's a bit of a reset, refocus year. I can do it, so why not do it? And I know next year's going to make me so much hungrier to go again. Whatever the next 5-year goal setting I'm going to be doing, whatever it looks like, I'm going to be hungry to go again and not, oh, I'm 40, that's me retired, because we know that's never going to happen.
Yeah. Are there any huge itches that are front of mind at the moment, this moment in time?
I want to learn how to grow a business. I know this seems really, really strange because I've got multiple businesses, but I feel like I don't have that skill set. I feel like I know property inside out. I feel like I'm fucking so good at collecting assets. I'm so good at doing it, none of my own money. You know, I really want to pass that on to people that interact with it. Doesn't matter your circumstances, your reality, your experience, whatever it may be, you can buy property with none of your own money. You can build a huge amount of wealth through property, and you don't need money. So to reverse that, I don't know how to manage people. I don't know marketing and sales strategy. I can't sell with a fuck. Like, I really am horrendous. Like, it's probably my biggest weakness. And I'm like, I'd like to develop that skill set. Maybe all the stuff that, it almost feels like I'm doing this in reverse. You know, most people would grow a business. They'd grow a fantastic business. They'd make multi-millions pounds. They'd sell out. Then they would go and invest into a property portfolio and that give them the financial freedom.
That continues to pay them. Yeah.
Whereas I've done it the complete, I think the hard way, where it's like, right, I want all these assets, I want this financial freedom, how do I do it without having the money? Oh, fuck, I need to learn a skill set on how to acquire the assets for a phenomenal price. I need to be able to raise the finance, I need to be able to add the value, I need to understand my marketplace, mix my strategies, but I know that. And now it's like, oh shit, now I need a business. Now I want to...
You have built a business in training and education though now.
Yes, but I've not scaled it.
Okay.
It's still reliant on me. So I'm not so good with the marketing and sales processes. So I'd like to learn these. I'd like to learn a new skill set.
Well, your funnels, your podcast.
Yes. And even doing
things like
that.
Which I think is so underrated. People don't realize how much of a connection. Like, the people that listen to me every week, like they're my army. They're like my people that support me and push me to do what I do. And the people that listen to you and Nick.
Yeah.
Of course they want to join your community and understand more. And that was something that came up in a solo Q&A recently. Mm. Oh, would you run like a meetup? And I was like, is there a demand for that? And then the number of messages I got was like genuinely notable, like high double figures. And I was like, that's like bizarre. I had no idea. I think the first step would be something like a Telegram or a Discord or something like that, where people can speak to each other that are other Cambro listeners. Mm. But you having that podcast, it makes total sense that you have like, that's your marketing, but you almost don't feel like you're marketing.
No, absolutely not. It's I think the key to that growth is that continuing progress is always growing. Like, I'm listening to your podcast and you're talking about your podcast course. I was like, brilliant, I'm gonna get that, because you're gonna come up with something on analysing guests and coming up with questions that I'm gonna like, oh, I'll learn that. So I always think that if you're opening your mind up to growing and not just stalling, that you've almost got that never-ending ceiling. And I look at the skill sets that I've developed and they tie into property, they tie into the assets, but they don't tie into business, whether it be management, whether it be, I think I'm good at marketing when it comes to the social media and the personal branding, but I'm not good at funnels and automation and AI, and the sales is completely the weakness. So it's like, oh, let me learn that, because that's transferable skills I can put in other businesses. Can I transfer that skill set into my martial arts business and then scale that one up? So I'm quite excited.
You've got
about
options
that.
There, you really do.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I find that's quite exciting. It's not whether the portfolio continues to grow or not. I don't know.
If you free up bandwidth from doing that, you're just going to assign it to something else. So it might as well be something that you're passionate about.
Absolutely, yeah. And don't get me wrong, because someone asked me this a few days ago, saying, no, you're not buying right now because you're focusing on growing the community and growing other businesses. And I'm getting off the short-term debt and getting on a long-term strategy, looking at the pain and looking at the business we've built too quickly, that we've almost created a beast with the portfolio. that were underestimated. So I'm almost backtracking that, cleaning up this year. But they said, oh, would you buy any more? And I'm just saying, yeah, the right deals. Like I get a buzz from it. If I know that there's a property on the market for £1 million or 100 grand and I know I can try and get it for 60 grand or 50 grand, like that's what excites me, to find that, find the creative way of how I can negotiate that and then how I can finance that. Like I'll like putting all the pieces of the puzzle together to go, I made that.
It's a great level of self-awareness, and I think that's what's going to lead to you continuing to pursue a life on your terms and with a little bit more freedom than ever before, while still enjoying some of these different areas, but pushing forward and forward and forward. And I knew I was going to enjoy today. Hope you've enjoyed yourself too, Stephen.
Yeah, love the chat.
And I'm sure the listeners will want to continue the conversation with you. Where should they head towards?
Instagram's probably the best place, Stephen Clark Property. Used to post up stories there, just showcasing the journey and the life and what's happening. I don't hold back a lot of the time. So yeah,
that'll be linked in the show notes. Thank you, Stephen, and thank you to the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.